very wonderful pre-memorial festival for the past several weeks, and we feel very privileged to have Brother Ray Luke with us for a few days, and especially today. He's going to speak to us on the subject, Our Lord's Passover. Did you hear that? That the Passover was Purim. Our Lord's Passover. So we're looking forward to it.
Thank you, Brother Tim. Certainly my pleasure, dear brethren, to be with you and to bring the loving greetings of our dear ones back home. The Jersey City class is happy to know that we're coming and to give you their love. And they ask that 2 Corinthians 9:8 be sent to you. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always having all sufficiency in all things may abound to every good work. Then, of course, the Father is rejoicing. And in that rejoicing, she sends her love, prayer, wishes that she could be here, but because of circumstances, that's not possible. But I want to know that she is doing wonderfully well, and that spiritual inspiration and grit, which has characterized her whole attitude during this past experience, is just about me. And we thank you all for your prayers, for your card, and we know for your wonderful family. As for myself, I'm the one who is privileged to be with you and to share with your pre-memorial festival. It's really been that for me. I got a good sample of it last Friday night when a rather spontaneous little desire to have fellowship meeting together. And the brethren simply that moved in a very informal way, and we just sat for about an hour and a half, and brethren was simply sharing how they curbed themselves in preparation for the Passover service itself. How do you empty yourself of all that which is leavened, which in a type was incumbent upon the Israelites? My one sister said she worked, or she knew somebody who would go into the very crevices and corners of her home with a toothpick and dig out any crumb or any kind of debris that would be leaven that might be contaminating the household. Now, with that as a picture, how much more are we then to examine ourselves whether we be in the truth and whether we are approaching that Passover table with the same sense of sobriety, reverence, and of concern that the typical people of Israel did. So I, you know, just felt very happy and thrilled to see her admonishing and being admonished and blessing and being blessed by the dear brethren here. Last night I woke up and wondered, what might I say today? So I might keep in that same theme. I'm keeping it at a festival level so that our mind will be in the heavenly and just zeroed in on and just geared towards that beautiful night of all nights which we will come to with burning hearts, I'm sure, and probe it into for the deepest profound identification with the emblem that means our identity with the death and with the life of Christ. And as I was trying to wonder, how can we put, we all know these things. They're also familiar to us. It's been a part of our Bible student heritage and understanding for the length of our complicated years. While our journey, our burden is to put it into practice. But how do you phrase it intellectually so there might be a little different approach? You know, every elder, every speaker tries to put his own personality into whatever subject he is interested in or saying or giving, and try to put it with a little different point of view that might arrest attention or settle the point or just give a further depth to that subject. So we thought perhaps it might be useful if we explored the way Jesus observed his Passover. How did he observe the Passover days as he lived and about his lifetime? Now, to be sure, we have very little information on which to base our assumptions or surmising or our thinking. I say very little, because the accounts are silent. We do know one thing for a fact, however, is that the Passover was very solemnized and very faithfully kept by the family of Jesus. For we read in Luke 2:41, it says, "Now his parents," that is Jesus' parents, "went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover." So I can imagine that this little boy Jesus, or this little baby Jesus, I'm sure after that first year when they came back from Egypt, whatever age it was, perhaps the age of 4 or 5, we're not clearly told that in written. But whenever it's possible, I can just imagine Mary and Joseph making that trek from Nazareth to Jerusalem year after year, joining in with that joyful multitude as they came down that parched area, and as they approached, probably a 3-day march or journey, as they approached to the holy city, and caught up in the ecstasy of that wonderful pilgrimage. How they were all just enraptured as they were preparing eagerly. For a month they had been setting their hearts and getting their homes in order so that they could take that journey. And as they were approaching, there was melody in their hearts, the songs were on their lips, and there was a joyful contagion everywhere. And the love and reverence and exuberance just seemed to fill their whole atmosphere. You can just enjoy the intensity of the spirit. There was this national desire to give glory to Jehovah, and this is a commemoration not only of our national liberation, but this was the commandment of our Lord that we should keep this for every year as a memorial throughout all generations. And so I can see how Jesus, from the earliest moment of years, was growing up and just imbibing and soaking in the atmosphere, and with his perfect intelligence, with his depth of knowledge of the scriptures, how the two were combining together, and he was understanding his role, his purpose, his work, and how he was now to carry out these rituals. So that at the age of 12, when he did go with his parents up to Jerusalem, and there, as it is in the second chapter of the book of Luke, there he was now. At that age, he was able to, I suppose it was what they call a son of the law, very similar to what they have today. When a Hebrew male becomes, I think it's 13 years from now, he becomes bar mitzvah, which means now he can stand before the synagogue. He can stand before the congregation. And now he is accepted into a state of manhood, and he therefore has an access to the blessings and to the ceremonies of the synagogue. And so at age 12, Jesus sat with the teachers, with the doctors of the law of the temple, in those august corridors, in those chambers where only the scholars, only those who were steeped in the law and who were at the level of a party were privileged to convene. And this stripling of a lad, this young Jesus, seated in their midst, not only answered their questions, I'm sure they probed him, but he pointed to them and gave out leading scriptures, questioning them as to the meaning of these prophecies or of these messianic promises. And as they listened to his understanding and the depth of his comprehension, they were sorely amazed. And they had to know that there was a power in this young lad that was far beyond their own or any that they had seen or witnessed. Remember, of course, how his parents came back and he gave them the first inkling of his commission in life, "Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business." Mary knew that he was a special child. The Annunciation of the Angels, 12 or 13 years prior, has indicated that. She treasured all these things into her heart. And Joseph knew that this was a son that was so different. Now, he himself recognized his commission. He recognized now his role and his relationship to his heavenly father. The text, the scripture, the writ is now silent thereafter. We don't know how Jesus celebrated his 13th birthday on until his 30th year. I'm sure it was celebrated in the same way. He joined with his parents down to the temple in Jerusalem, there to offer his praise and adoration for the ritual of the Passover. But more importantly, there to identify his calling and how he was going to work out and he's going to be the candidate of that lamb that was slain. That lamb whose blood that was sprinkled could not bring life, could not bring freedom from sin and bondage to death. But that blood which he would spill ultimately then fulfill all the hopes of Israel, would provide the basis upon which all mankind would then be blessed. That's portrayed in the innumerable scriptures that foretold his life and his death. And so I thought that now if we could just consider how the Master spent the remaining Passover of his life, that might be profitable for our study this afternoon, this morning. And as I approached it, I realized that it was not quite as simple as one might think. Because my first approach was to look in the scriptures as to where the Passover is mentioned and to try to recount them and simply extrapolate them from the text and then build a little framework about each one and then talk a little bit about the experiences that the Master is enduring and then apply it to ourselves here. How would it draw a parallel? Oh, I said last night that would be an excellent structure for remarks to share with the brethren this morning. But as I came into the text, as I tried to pull these little fragments of truth from the text, it was not quite that simple. And I think we got a beautiful perspective a little bit as to how Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John saw the same sequence of events and how they recorded those events, just as you have found in your consideration of the same areas of thought in the putting together the fragments of facts, and you put together a mosaic that would make a consistent story, because many of the critics of the Bible, many of the agnostics, and many of the higher critics, and those who would say that there is no divine inspiration to these writings, because there seems to be so many inconsistencies. You just can't seem to put all those little pieces like a jigsaw together so that it makes one harmonious whole. Well, if you approach it from strictly a legalistic, or strictly from a logical point of view, or strictly from a biased framework, setting up your own criteria and saying it doesn't quite fit into my expectation, therefore it cannot be consistent and must therefore be invalid, that certainly is not the case. Because even though there seem to be fragments that seem to be a little bit distorted, as for example, this matter of Jesus bearing his cross, how we see that three of the disciples, or the evangelists, express it in their terms, and John comes along and puts his additional insights into the scene. Because we see that John was the last writer of the four evangelists and the four gospels, and therefore he had access to the writings of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew was an eyewitness to all the events that he had written, and Mark was really the historian of Peter. Peter was the source of all of Mark's writings in the Gospel. Luke was a historian, and he received much of his information from, it is assumed, from Mary and the other apostles. while Paul was in prison in Jerusalem. And Luke was with him, we know. And therefore, he had ample time, perhaps 2 years, in which to conduct his research into the gospel. And it is assumed that Mary was still living, and she was a fruitful source of information for his documentation. And so John comes along, and he is able to get the perspective, having been so intimately associated with the Master. John comes along and then fills in all the little details, puts in, as it were, the background material, so that as we put the composite of the four Gospels together, we get a beautiful mosaic and a beautiful picture. And while they simply are not in the same style, if you examine their structure, they are not in chronological order. The style is so uniquely distinct that it, to me, characterizes the individuality of the writers. There is no collusion. There was no fictional writing, there was no editing. It was strictly them writing from their experience, or from direct experience, as the Spirit overruled and directed and guided. So with that perspective, we look at the accounts of the Passover. And as you look into Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you will find that there's only one Passover that is referred to in all of their lives. And that is the last Passover, the Passion Week, the Passover that the Master took off with his disciples at which, or after which time, he initiated the memorial service. But yet we know that certainly Jesus had to observe other Passovers prior to that last one. Now this also brings up a very interesting question, which I found that many critics are divided. They look into the book of John, the Gospel of John, and they say there are only three Passovers that Jesus attended there. And they say he must have attended or had four Passovers. Because if he lived for 3.5 years, and if we were to take October of the year 29 as a consecration, the first Passover that he would celebrate as a new creature would be in April of the year 30. The second would be April of the year 31. The third would be in the year 32 of April. And then the year in which he was crucified was AD 33. Now therefore, there would be four Passovers that he attended after his consecration at Jordan. And if we look at the book of John, we find three of them are clearly pointed out. John 2, 13, 23, 1. Then John 6, 4, another. And then John 11, 55, and 12, 1. All related to the fourth Passover, which is mainly comprehended in the 13th chapter of John. And so now we come. How do we count for that fourth year, that fourth Passover? Some scholars say that if you only went to three Passovers, that means he's only lived for only 2.5 years in his life as a new creature. Well, we know it was 3.5 years. We know that he lived 3.5 years in the tenure of the Jewish gospel, because Daniel 7 years later. That prophecy tells us that it was in the midst of the week that he was cut off. And that last week was 7 years of length. And the midst of the week, therefore, would be 3.5 years. So the Messiah appeared at the end of the 6th of the 9th week. And then he lived into the 70th week for 3.5 years. The midst of the week, therefore, was 3.5 years. And so he had to attend four Passovers. And I submit to them that there is indicated again in the book of John. Let us just briefly go through some of these Passovers and see if we can reconcile what seems to be a conflict of the intent. We note that in the first reference in John 2, we find a very useful account following the marriage at Cana, the first miracle, which is clearly shown to us in the early part of these chapters. And as we go through the second chapter of John, we note that it comes to the fourth verse. It says, after this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brethren and his disciples, and they continued there not many days. And the 13th verse, and the Jewish Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So now we need to hear the other doctrine. This and found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the savings of money and children. And when he had made spread the small cloth, he drove them all out of the temple and every sheep and the oxen and poured out the change of money and over through the table. And said unto them that sold those, take these things hence. Make not my father's house a house of merchandise. And the disciples remembered us, it was written, the door of that house that we knew of, and so forth, down to the 22nd verse. Now it has ended the problem. Does that mean that there were two cleansings of the temple? Was there a cleansing of the temple at the beginning of the master's ministry, as well as at the very end? Now that there was a cleansing at the end of the master's ministry during those 6 last days in Jerusalem, there can be no question. You are the believers that considered that matter in the last 6 days. And I believe it was the second or third day that the Adonijah in the Companion Bible expresses that Jesus cleansed the temple on Jesus' day. I'm not privy to a discussion, therefore I was interested in knowing your conclusion. But this does pose a problem to us now. Was there apparently a third cleansing, if you're going to say the second and third days were a cleansing in that last week in Jerusalem? Brother Uncle has a little thought on John 21:22. And he addresses this thought without going into the scholarship of it or without trying to give any depth speaking of the context. But he says that there are some who say that there are two cleansings, but in his understanding, they do so without sufficient authority. And quote, he says, to our understanding, Jesus began his teaching in a rather quiet manner, reserving many of his mightiest works for the last. I suggested that this was the writing of John, not in chronological order, but rather it was John putting forth the incident in a kind of grouping. And he put the Passover together with this, as though it were a parenthetical inscription between the 14th verse and the 22nd verse. Almost as though he lifted it out and put it into this context because it was a historical fact. And not because it was sequential in chronological array or order. Certainly there's no dispute that there was a cleansing of the temple. But the point that for Jesus to have begun his ministry at such a point before he had even begun to demonstrate the authority and messiahship, before he had performed the miracle, before he was preaching his doctrine and gospel of truth, before he could impart to them the spiritual teachings that were paramount in his ministry, would be contrary to his whole method of ministry. He was prepared to speak, and then he came with the strong meat and with the activity and action, and always prepared the groundwork before he executed the chapter 4 and the remainder in that chapter. And therefore, in then the first chapter, in the 23rd verse, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed in his name and they saw the miracles which he did. We did not know the miracles because they were done in Cana and the changing of water into wine was the first of it. So apparently there were other great acts not committed to the account. But the 24th verse goes on to say that Jesus did not commit himself on his own, because he knew all men, and he did not let any to testify of man, for he knew what was in man. In other words, at this point, we recognize that they were only concerned with the miracles of the work. They wanted the signs. They wanted the benefits. They wanted the physical manifestation. They wanted the help. They wanted the physical evidence. But Jesus did not need their praise, or did not curry their favor, because he knew that they were very sensitive and very fickle. That they were in his place. And so he was very subdued in the manifestation of his authority at this particular time. And he finds the result of that praise. Because anybody considering developing a master, he was interested in working with the university. And so at the third chapter of the time, that Mr. Dingley now recognizes some of the evidences of the master, and he then has this beautiful dialogue. Art thou really the master? We know that only one who can do this work has to be from God. This is not the work of man. Therefore, tell me more about this. And the master, in this beautiful company, in this self-deceptive way, he's able to cut through all of the burdens, all of the fears, all of the question comes up problematic. And as he tries to portray and portraying his spiritual truth to natural minds is almost a contradiction of terms. He's able to convey to one who is thinking only in concrete terms what it means to be dwelling in the spirit, to serve God in the flesh, away from the flesh, the ritualistic, legalistic effect. It's so difficult for him to get through. And try to measure Nicodemus, preaching this, acting the work part of the law, how difficult it has to be. What does it mean to worship God and spread him through? And to be not born, but rather to be forgotten again by the Spirit. Or would not go into the now and how it's really clear and how our Christian friends who see this in terms only of birth rather than as the devil gossip are missing the whole beauty of what it means to be spiritually begotten before you can be developed at the end of your Christian growth and development and maturity to the point of birth and full development in Christ Jesus. But Nicodemus was able to perceive what the master said, that truly he has a message serving God that he needed to find and he was looking for. And here was written in his mind and heart a devotion and a love which he believed grew and was developing into a follower of the Master. And the Master gave him such a beautiful example as the side of his point, my early attended problem, how Moses was lifted up of the serpent in the wilderness, even so much the Son of Man being lifted up, showing how the sacrifice would be carried out, pointing towards the atonement that God had in store, and then God so loved the world that he was only begotten Son, that his brother believed in him did not perish, but had everlasting life. And then, after he did this, because again, Jesus is encountered with a little conflict here between the some of John's disciples and the Jews about Jerusalem, and the jealousies are coming up now, who is the greater? John has been baptizing, and the Jews are having their way of speaking, and now the Master is doing his own ministry, and there seems to be a little bit of misunderstanding about this. And the Master was showing how John was merely a forerunner, merely pointing towards the work that Jesus would do. And now that God's unity is how there should be
Jesus is working, and that Jesus makes your increase in love, your increase. And we know too, at this moment in time, John the Baptist was seeing him pass in his face. This was the first couple that our master experienced as a new creature. There was one of blessing, there was also one of entangling problems. He began to recognize how ministry was beginning to run into opposition, misunderstanding, how it was not being accepted. It was put on very material levels, and how he was trying to go to the elevation of the spirit, and how difficult it was to get that across. Then he goes back, and the fourth chapter opens up. And says, and therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, so Jesus himself baptized not but his disciples. He left Judea and departed again into Galilee. He perceived that the opposition was not coalition, that he was now going to meet this oppression, and he was not going to be unnecessarily submitting himself to what he did. Therefore, as the word he speaks to Galilee. And in Galilee is the spiritual Galilean ministry, where most of his miracles were performed, and of which John has the least of all his great accounts, and that of Matthew and Mark have the most. In Galilee, he performed all of these great and glorious works that characterized him as the Messiah. But you know that he goes to Samaria, he has that marvelous encounter with the woman of the world, and then as he performs his miracles in Galilee, he then, in the sixth chapter, in the first verse, he reads, and after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem, by the street market of Paul. Now the question arises, was this feast the feast of Baptist? And many commentators are of the persuasion that it must be, because this is the only other feast that we don't have already identified that would possibly account for that mystery passed over time. Now we know this is the only way of discussing the feast, and we will turn to the 23rd chapter of the book of Luke. And I think at this time of the year, it is so appropriate that we do that. But just to touch the subject, we know in the 23rd chapter that there were three feasts that were spelled out for the Jews to observe. To be sure, in the 5th verse down to the 7th verse, the Lord Passover. That was to be an observed, a sacred holiday that was falling to death, that week of unleavened bread. And then we come down to the 11th verse, there was to be a wave offering, a wave that speaks before the Lord, to be acceptable for you on tomorrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave. And then there was to be sacrifices of bread together with that wave of peace offering. And that wave of peace offering was to be the day after the Sabbath of the Passover. And then from that point on would be seven more Sabbaths, and the 50th day would be the day of Pentecost. And so that would be the Pentecost feast. The Sabbath, the Passover, the Sabbath, and then 50 days of Pentecost. Now we note that Brother Russell suggests, and he suggests this as the most probable and most compelling reason for the belief that Jesus was crucified on a Sabbath. Because the great offering was to follow the Sabbath. Now the Sabbath was on a Saturday, and the day following would be on a Sunday. And if Jesus was crucified just before the Sabbath, before the time of preparation, it had to be there the day before, which would be on a Friday. And inasmuch as the labor offering, you see, was a picture about the resurrection, that is so appropriate that the type showed in the flesh. And therefore, the 15th day after the rib offering would indicate then the millennium, the time of all the resurrection came about, and when the glorious blessings would be for all mankind in the glorious kingdom of the world. This is so beautiful for us there and then in these types of all. And then the next piece that is ancestry, would be the Feast of Tabernacles, Leviticus 23:34-43, which is in October the following year, and this is the gathering of the harvest and the eating of it under their boots or the slippers. Then there are two more ancestors services or holidays. One must be the Feast of Dedication. And this was in December, started by the Jewish Maccabeans. It was a purifying of the temple after the desecration by Antiochus Epiphanes. And we know that this is not listed as a gem upon the Jews, but nonetheless, the account says in John 10:22, if we would read, that it was observed. Let us read John 10:22. And it was at Jerusalem, the feast of the dedication, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. So Jesus did go to Jerusalem at that time, the feast of the dedication. And then we know he also went to Jerusalem for another feast, which was the feast of the tabernacles, in John 7:2-10, where we read, now the Jews feasted at Tabernacles of the tent. And the tent first, when his brethren were gone up, then went he also up under the sea, not openly, but as were in the sea. We will come back to that. But it just interjected at this point to illustrate the fact that there were these five feasts, only three of which were incumbent upon the Jews by the war. But then the second Passover, it is surmised, was here in John 5:1. After that, there was a feast for the Jews. It doesn't say which one. It seems to be the only feast that is not labeled, that is another account for. And therefore, it is assumed that that must be for the second Passover that he was intended at Jerusalem. Now we know that in that tent, he raised again the veil over the suffering aspect of his man. When he went there, he remembered he saw the young man, the old and the withered man by the shore of the Strata. And remember how, as he saw those waters and those poor wretched creatures just about the shore, waiting and praying and hoping for some miraculous turn the water to make this one great festival in the end of the world. And as he surveyed all this poor wreck of humanity, he singled out one man who seemed to be the most suitable, or the most humble, the most penitent, the most reverent. And he approached the man, and he asked a very odd question. Wilt thou be made whole? What a question to ask! Now he has been there all these years past, waiting for some miraculous occurrence. And as he looked into that man's eyes and asked that question, he was doing this not only out of compassion, but also knowing thoroughly that he was now about to raise the ire and the fury and the wrath of the hierarchy in Jerusalem. He deliberately put forth, aggressively picked up his cross. Then man will be mounted twice and let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Although we can deny ourselves, we can consecrate to be sure, but rather than truly take up the cross, in a very aggressive self for putting forth God's spirit and exposing ourselves for righteous intent, unless we go the next step, we cannot fulfill our appetite. And so the master asked the question, which was obviously he knew the answer. And he said to this man, pick up that thing and walk. Again, he was talking to the deputy. For now, commanding this man to take up his bed and walk, he was enforcing the law of the Sabbath on two accounts. One was he was healing on the Sabbath, and secondly, he was causing this man to also break the Sabbath by picking up his bed and walk. But he didn't do so. Because he knew the time had now come for Israel to rapidly propagate Jewish teaching, and no longer was he to be preparing, rather he was now rapidly fulfilling. And then you remember that this policy in the 18th verse of the 25th chapter, that what is Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken his path, but so also that God was his God, making himself equal to Christ. I say this verse in Passover experience. It's an experience where the adversary, to be sure, was aggressively seeking to get him out of the way. And it's also an experience in which he was now facing the full wrath of his opponent. And the Jewish power was now raised against him. The God had been cast, that is in the fire. And now he knew that from henceforth there was nothing but persecution. To be sure, his ministry and glory was relatively, he was able to do all good works of compassion. He was in Jerusalem. The hotbed of Judea, the very seat of authority of religious power, that gave him the greatest persecution. And now that persecution was beginning to come. And after delivering these scathing remarks, then Prince Walking Strong too, he was then sent away. And he went back to Galilee. Now I think another part of the account presents itself to us. In the sixth chapter of John in the first verse, it says, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee. This is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him, and sit down to the four first. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, is now. Now we note one thing, that the whole fifth chapter of John apparently was 1 year ago. We have nothing to follow in the filling account beyond the single two. And know that whenever we see this will of God after these things, and John and his brothers are to leave, usually it's 10 different months. It is an indefinite period of time. Ordinary and believe this is just immediately after this decision, these things happen. But rather you will note, and in this study, please keep aware that after these things is an indefinite period of time. It's all it was a statement of thereafter. Not saying when or how long, but simply a statement that following whatever period of time, the next stage is going to occur. But at this point, it was a third Passover. Now we know that there was a Passover, and in all that apparently, Jesus did not go to Jerusalem. Because the Passover was nigh, and Jesus was here at the Sea of Galilee. And here he did those marvelous miracles. He said to the 5,000, he calmed the waters at the Sea of Galilee. He walked on the water. And he preached the beautiful words of the beautiful Sermon on the Mount. It was apparent that he remained away from Jerusalem. Perhaps sensing that the pressure was mounting, that they were searching for him, his time had not yet come, he had not yet finished his work in Galilee, and not directly exposing himself, he sent his Passover, blessing the people, forming his miracles, and in the quiet surroundings of Bethany. That was to be his last and only quiet Passover. I say quiet in the sense of relatively speaking, because the very next year, well, this is our duty, the 12th, Then we go into 6 months after this. My time is almost up, so that's why I'm just sitting here. We move down to the 7th chapter, and we note that they would not walk in Jerusalem, but there was a feast of tabernacles. And that was 6 months after the Passover that we had just completed. And then he did go to Jerusalem, because there was a special need to do so because of his brethren, and for him to put forth the finishing touches on his ministry. And he stayed there, it wasn't caught and come back, but there was still a new ministry built that was doing at this point. And then he ended in that last year, for that last week of that. And all the accounts that were specifically clear and vividly read before after what they said at that time. We know how that last chapter was the one that culminated in 20 years. It was then that he, with a full self-intensity, we had so short time to be ready to travel, but he was trying to say to them for 3.5 years. And as he took back upon his presence, how seemingly people they were seeing the intent of him doing one of them to pass. The money store that I'm now in debt. They were vying for who's going to put it to the left hand, who's going to put it to the right hand. They were, one of them was even thinking of, well, he's the president. And as he looked upon the efforts of American countries, and as he went to his left, Tom was in the building chapel, and then to burn the bell of consciousness, a real meaning of the past, and the fulfilling of the past, the fulfilling of the past, to see God, he fulfilled that past. And now we enter to this goodness place, a new and a higher spirit, and that was to be what we call the memorial, the bread and the meat on it. And we cannot begin this thing. Sometimes we think about that. We put you into the mold of mind and the mood that we must to get that to a really that much of the time. To just think of this darkness, you know, the boding and the agonizing, foreboding future that he's had. And how the disciples themselves are just caught up in fear, in anxiety, and doubt, and misunderstanding. They didn't believe that there was anything to possibly happen. The audience of the world was supposed to do this. All of their expectations that they now were just too evaporated. It was a matter of, I would tell them months earlier about the fact that he didn't know that. But they couldn't quite comprehend it. It was just too much for them to believe. Just one who didn't help all the prophets. Numbers of all his power and power. Now this happened. It couldn't be. Just go through them to Adam. Then on the afternoon, the shepherd and goats and pagans. And those fortunes have been just stayed in for every night. And now they have to say in this definition of God. How those heavens of heart, and how he was thinking not only of those who went and called the religion of all the church throughout the last day. How are they going to understand the one of the Father? How can we grasp what it means to be really members of the same body, same organism of Christ? Or is that concept that he had, even with the Spirit of God, we simply have to just cut that and hope that we can begin to imagine some of the happiness in God. That's why it's so important that we get our minds away from the things of our intent and kind of try to enter into the world. I don't think that it's too much to talk about that, but into the spirit of life really means. He's like the sound through the spirit of all the and we're trying to hold on to the rest of them. And this is what the matter is trying to convey of them by the setting up of this tomorrow. So then, when you break up, I'm going to do so this year for the greatest sensitivity and realize that I am swallowed up and I want to go. And that in all likelihood, then there will not be some of us here next year to vibrate the rejoice. We don't know what the story is all about tonight. We don't know what the day is here for the world. But we need to know that this we do is what we do. We are the truth, and without knowledge. And if we examine ourselves, as Peter expresses that we are the truth, 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 we are the rings that are broken, crusted that top of that one roof, plates that are mingled and grooves that are smooth to that one top, Jesus being all mingled together as one body. How can we catch it and how loving and gentle we should be to one another? And how in Hebrews, I believe it's 12, 16, that this whole process that we are being looked at. Look within yourself, living. Let any man say of the grace of God, let them who have bitterness bring up trouble to us, that we would purge, expunge, and just take out of our being anything that might possibly contaminate, that might possibly not be consistent with the spirit of this world, that we would not have any bitterness, hostility, anger, or the other brother. If there is anything between any of us, let us make a man for the man. Let us spread the way, let us be driven in Christ in the way that we are. That's what the Master is all about. Let nothing be changed. And so we went through his death after us and instituted to memorial service. The reverend who goes through our world memorial service, it might be the 50th or it might only be the first or the whatever. Many years we've been confused and privileged to have this service. But we do know that this is how I look at it. This is the moment which we all get for. Because in this service, we've invited the full meaning of what it means to be present. And the whole greatest service. Other than perhaps the baptism of service, but it's just the reception of the election. There are no greater Christian descendants than I can have here. Let us, and this is before our God, enable and their conscience for the effects toward men as well, enable to say that they are perfect with us, and living up to the requirements of these enemies and others. May the Lord have his blessing.
Grant us more than we can to that place, that we might know you better